The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
John Gibbons for the weekly Last Word on the Environment. Ben Finnegan earlier gave us in the 5 for 5 some of the outlines of what's in the Environmental Protection Agency report, saying that there are serious deficits in the government's environment legislation and policy programmes. What do you make of that?
Yeah, good evening, Matt. I think if I were a student, let's say, coming home with this report card, my parents would definitely be putting my phone in one of those pouches. That's for sure. I mean, to run through the scorecard very briefly, right? If we start with nature status in Ireland is rated as very poor and not improving. Overall climate status, poor. Water quality, poor. And circular economy, poor. I mean, this is orange and red writ right across the EPA report. It really is not good news. And there's not a huge amount of light at the end of the tunnel in this. And this is interestingly really, because obviously we've just had 4 years of a green tinged government, right? Now I think we have to, I suppose, be aware of first of all the fact that that was just a tinge, no more. And secondly, I was looking at a couple of the stats on this, Matt, just looking back. In 2020, the total budget for the National Parks and Wildlife Service to look after everything, our national parks, our nature reserves, the works, was about under 30 million euros. Now, that has increased since. The budget, say, just for the six national parks, about 7 million. So what that really said is, as recently as 4 years ago, nature protection, biodiversity protection was a complete political afterthought. No government in the last 15 years, up until, I should say, 2020, there was no champion for nature, for biodiversity, or for serious climate action. And we had this massive lacuna, and you'll remember it well as a commentator, basically after the crash of 2008-2011, that's what they call that green shite, basically got thrown overboard. We can't afford to be green, we have to fix the economy, etc., etc. And some of the catastrophic consequences of the panic that ensued from then, for example, are breakneck rush into dairy expansion and all the negative consequences, which, by the way, are written all over this report. This is the kind of consequences that come from that, where there's such a poor political routing. So few politicians, Matt, are prepared to come into this studio or any other studio and actually defend nature, defend wildlife, defend clean water, clean air, biodiversity. They'll talk about it, but the first sign of a vested interest, the first sign of somebody making a few bob off tearing up a bog or ripping up a mountain, and they back off and say, oh, no, no, no. And this, I'm sad to say, is a factor of our politics in Ireland. Maybe it's our multi-seat constituencies, which of course are on the one hand, they're splendidly democratic, but on the other hand, what we get basically is client politics.
I'll tell you something else that I've been getting a bit exercised about recently, John, and it's, I've said this a number of times to you and I've said it elsewhere, that the failure to get all of the wind farms, particularly offshore, operational, to exercise the planning permissions and to get the things built and to provide the energy off them. But it's actually worse than that, because what we actually have is, at the moment, believe it or not, an excess of clean energy at times, which just gets wasted. There's nowhere for it to go because there's been a failure by the state to invest in the grid that would actually be able to not just take that energy and use it in Ireland. We could be a net exporter of clean energy.
I mean, that is still a pathway, Matt, that is possible. I genuinely believe it is, especially once we get offshore wind. The thing is, so far,
you can do the offshore wind now. The problem is we haven't invested the money in the infrastructure, the networks, the grids, to accommodate that. So we have situations at present where wind farms, the turbines are switched off because it could produce too much electricity to leave them on. Or the electricity is generated and then is just released effectively into the air, which just sounds absolutely bonkers.
It does sound bonkers. And again, without kind of going into a full technical drill down on how grids work, it is important to say that when you have a lot of renewable energy on a grid, you're going to have a certain amount of waste. Now, in certain jurisdictions, they're starting to get really smart about this. So, for example, they say, right, if we've got surplus wind on the grid and we can't handle it, would you, for example, dump it into your electric car? Would you, you know, is there some other storage point?
You could have batteries, electric batteries, giant electric batteries, which can store and then put the electricity into the system a number of hours later.
Sure. Now, of course, if you've got a few hundred thousand electric cars all plugged in, they effectively amount to a virtual power station or two. So this type of technology, this type of capability is there. It has been super difficult to get it closed on. And I again go back to where I started from. So few politicians in Ireland have given the slightest more than a token nod in the direction of this. And there's been so much focus, Matt, in as well. And I'd say led by economists, and I'm sorry to say, but reflected in the media over the last few years on the cost of this and the cost of that and the cost of the other. And what we've had as a result, a country which should be a world leader in renewable energy, a country that should be, if you like, a trailblazer in many of these things. We're mired in those issues you describe.
Okay, but then you might not like this, but I think one of the problems is that we then look and say we don't want things like data centres because they use too much electricity. The problem is we can actually generate plenty of electricity for these data centres, which the foreign companies, the foreign multinationals in Ireland need and want. And if we don't actually produce the energy for them and feed it to them, we're actually going to lose the corporation tax revenues of the future that we need.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain amount of truth in that, but I will say that we had a colossal increase in data centre energy consumption in Ireland on our electrical grid. We went from a situation where we had about 3% of our electricity, Matt, being used for data centres to about, I think, approaching 20%.
21%,
yeah,
actually.
And this happened, by the way, in just a few years. Now, you can't just suddenly add on, effectively increase your grid by that amount in such a short time. You see, it's super easy to add a data centre. They're easy, relatively speaking, to build. They're super easy to build. What is really complex is to increase your electrical grid. Let me give an example. Let's say I want to run a new 400 kilovolt line over your house, right? How do you feel about that? And this is what we're getting into, that when you want to extend the grid, you're going to get that type of pushback.
You know, funny, Justin, this is as an aside, because we will be sort of talking about America now in a moment, but because of the incredible demand for data centres in the United States, and there's been enormous $100 billion plus funds set up to build it, well, Microsoft is taking over Three Mile Island. Remember the famous
nuclear power station, sure.
And it's going to restart it to actually power these data centres. But funny enough, you actually have been on this programme previously supportive of nuclear as the cleanest form of electricity generation.
Well, it's certainly up there. I think the key thing about nuclear is if you have a nuclear plant working well, don't shut it down. We've seen, for example, probably the cleanest electricity in Europe is coming from France. About 70% of their nuclear energy comes from 59 power stations. I'll give a quick quiz to your listeners. Name me one French power station. And the short answer is nobody could, because they have worked away quietly, Matt, for the last 50 years, generating some of Europe's not just cleanest, but cheapest electricity.
They have, and we actually import much of that electricity. The hypocrisy that we won't allow nuclear generation on this island, and yet we're actually happy to use it when it's generated elsewhere.
And when we get the direct French interconnector, exactly, we should be able to swap French nuclear electrons for Irish wind electrons, yeah.
Okay. You were listening to Cal Thomas yesterday, because I brought up with Cal the impact of Hurricane Helene's historic flooding. And he's quite dismissive of the impact of man-made climate change. He thinks you can go back a century ago and you'll find similar floods. Actually, I don't think you will really, will you?
Not really, no. And again, I had a look at this because there have been various climate specialists doing what are called attribution analysis studies around Helene and also around the recent European floods. And essentially what they found, for example, we estimate the observed rainfall, this is in relation to Helene, was made 20 times more likely in these areas because of global warming. And I was doing a few quick calculations, Matt. For example, you mentioned on the show yesterday that Helene dumped 40 trillion gallons of rain. And I was kind of going, what the heck is 40 trillion gallons? So I did the numbers. That amounts...
It's a bit different from when we hear in our bulletins it was an inch of rain.
Exactly. So what is 40 trillion gallons? I've translated it into tons of water. So Hurricane Helene dumped 150 billion tons of water on a concentrated band across the US. This is incredible. To use the phrase biblical, and there's one stat that really, really jumped out at me, right? There's an area called Asheville in North Carolina. They experienced 20 inches of water in over a three-day period. Now, the scientists calculated that 8.4 inches of water over a three-day period would have been categorized as a once-in-1,000-year event. Now, to address what Cal was getting at, yes, we've always had extreme weather events in the past. What we now have is extreme weather on steroids. Basic physics, Cal. For example, when you add 1 degree centigrade to atmospheric temperature, the carrying capacity of the atmosphere for moisture increases by 7%. We're currently at about 1.2 degrees, so we're carrying almost 10% extra moisture in the atmosphere. That means we have a supercharged atmosphere. I'll put it to you this way. If current climate were an athlete and it was running a race, it would be basically doing the 100 metres in about 6 seconds. And you'd be looking at it and going, that's impossible. That is physiologically impossible. And I'd be saying to you, that athlete is doped to the gills. So what we have essentially here is weather on steroids.
There's incredible consequences for that. And it's not just for the people who died in the United States over the last week, at least 150, but there's about 600 other people missing. So you can imagine what the final total is going to be. Not just the loss of life, but the destruction of property, which has to be replaced, the insurance costs. It does strike me as rather strange that you have all of these businesses that are involved in denying man-made climate change who fail to see the economic consequences to them and to the greater US economy. When the number of extreme floods now, I think compared to about half a century ago, we get 4 to 5 times as many of these floods, let alone the volume of what's in the flooding.
That's correct. And one of the stats that really jumped out at me the other day is that they reckon that of the people whose properties were destroyed by Hurricane Helene, approximately 1% had flood insurance. These people are ruined. Also, as an aside, and maybe you might think it's slightly off the beam, but tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of livestock were drowned. Really gruesome death. Because, of course, there is no way, as farms and so on and factory units were flooded out, there was no exit plan. There was no escape for them. And it's a really, truly grisly side note on this.
Well, just very briefly, that's America, but also the recent European floods are much more pertinent to us, perhaps.
That's right. First of all, Matt, Europe is 2.3 degrees centigrade warmer than Europe was in the second half of the 19th century. That is a shocking statistic. So we have a completely different climate across Europe. And what we found with the recent European floods is, well, first of all, we had fewer deaths, again, because of better planning in Europe and better preparation. But we had billions of euros worth of damage. And we know, for example, that these events are getting more intense and they're getting, and essentially the rain is coming down harder, it's coming down faster, as a result of this. And what we know is that basically the overall atmospheric heating, whether it's in Europe and, for example, in America, what you have is the Gulf of Mexico is the great engine room that fuels these devastating storms. But even here in Europe, because we're heating faster, much faster than the world average, we're starting now to get pummeled by extreme heat waves, followed by these intense precipitation events. It's all basic physics, Matt.
We've got to leave it there. John Gibbons, thank you very much for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.